KALW.
Caltrans knew for years the freeway was vulnerable to quake damage.
Question, are you and your family prepared for the next big earthquake?
Even with all this prep, we're still not going to be prepared. There's still things that are going to happen that we can't stop.
Meet San Francisco's Neighborhood Emergency Response Team. Then a homeless encampment resident talks about the recent sweeps.
I have to think constantly, is it safe for me to be able to leave my home and go to work? Because I just don't know whether parking enforcement will show up and, you know, could do something to my vehicle.
And we'll hear readings celebrating San Francisco history.
I've gathered hundreds of visually inspiring original artworks that invite you to examine and challenge your own perceptions about disability.
A new special episode of New Arrivals. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. It's been 34 years since the Loma Prieta earthquake changed San Francisco and the Bay Area forever. And although you probably know about some of the things the earthquake destroyed, you may not know about the things it helped create, like NERT, the Neighborhood Emergency Response Team. It started as a way to prepare for natural disasters, but it's got some problems that are man-made. KALW's Ren Farrell went out to see what role NERT might play in the city's next big emergency.
Flares are just like extinguishers. They are really, really important to have and use, but by the time you want to use it, you are stuck on the side of the road, and it is very dark, and you're going to pull it out of your emergency kit, and you're going to be like, how do I use this?
At the end of November, more than 50 people met at San Francisco Fire Station Number 7, just off of Folsom Street in the Mission.
You take this, strike, and you're striking it away.
That's the sound of a flare being lit. They're here for the fire department's monthly Neighborhood Emergency Response Team, or NERT, training.
So, cannot walk, broken leg. That's the one that we moved over here.
Today, they're learning how to use fire extinguishers and flares, how to turn off gas lines, how to triage a building for emergency responders, and how to crib.
We're lifting. Right, stick that wedge block in there.
Cribbing is when you create a temporary structure to support or lift a heavy load. It can be used in search and rescue missions to free people who are trapped under rubble.
Just keep it right there, okay? Lifting. As we lift!
At the end of the training, Chief Erica Hu arrives to speak for the graduation ceremony.
We can't thank each and every one of you for taking the time to complete this program. Because when the next disaster hits, and it's not a matter of if, it's going to be when, we will need your help.
Everyone passes, either getting certified or recertified.
Alan, where are you, Alan?
Here.
They get NERT ID cards, hard hats, some tough-looking gloves, bright green NERT vests, and a t-shirt. Everyone shakes hands, gets their stuff, and then we all go outside to take a picture. The mood is joyous when everyone says goodbye, which is almost ironic, considering what everyone is here for.
Good evening, I'm Dave McElhattan.
And I'm Wendy Dakuta.
The roof and the second floor came down on her.
The quake sucked up the city's roughly $6 million reserve fund.
Caltrans knew for years the freeway was vulnerable to quake damage.
In the East Bay, the I-880 collapsed.
In 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake devastated the Bay Area. Freeways and buildings collapsed. 63 people died, and almost 4,000 were injured.
Thousands of marina residents displaced from their homes.
And officials are saying that the number of people needing help is growing as more.
The marina, which is built on top of landfill, was hit particularly hard by the earthquake. Some marina residents found themselves performing search and rescue missions and helping to put out fires.
I remember it all vividly. 15-year-old high school student.
This is Captain Brandon Tom. He was a student at San Francisco's Lowell High School when the Loma Prieta earthquake hit.
I was at Stonestown and I watched the signs shake and the cars lose control and the waves in the ground.
Now, 34 years later, he's captain of the NERT program for the San Francisco Fire Department.
Regular citizens were in the street directing traffic, helping traffic go by. And then you saw in the news that people were helping put out fires. I didn't learn, you know, how important that was until later.
After the earthquake, people living in the marina asked the SF Fire Department to start a disaster training class, and NERT was born. NERT is a free 6-week training program. It's not as intense as training is for emergency responders, but it does teach some basic and crucial skills. It's supposed to empower regular citizens to help out the fire department when the next earthquake hits.
As all the studies have said, that's not the big one. There's going to be a bigger one that's going to occur.
So how does NERT factor into the city's disaster plan? Let's say a magnitude 8 earthquake hits. Buildings collapse, freeways are closed, there's no BART or electricity. The fire department would divide the city into 10 battalions, or mini cities, and treat those battalions separately.
So each battalion will take inventory of what they need, the resources, and deploy as they see fit. And within each battalion, the NERT-trained volunteers will show up at a staging area and assist the fire department as the battalion chief directs them.
Staging areas are just agreed-upon meeting places, high schools, community centers, parking lots, etc.
If one battalion is fine versus the others, we can shift resources as the city needs.
So that's the way things are supposed to go. NERT teams would tackle different neighborhoods, basically being the eyes and ears of the fire department. But Captain Tom says even this won't be enough.
Even with all this prep, we're still not going to be prepared. There's still things that are going to happen that we can't stop.
And there's another problem. There aren't nearly enough NERT-certified people in the city as there should be. According to Captain Tom, ideally 5% of San Francisco's population would be NERT certified. That comes out to about 40,000 people. But right now, there are maybe 10,000 NERT certified people in San Francisco. And where those people live is unevenly distributed. Higher income neighborhoods are far more likely to have NERT members.
The further out neighborhoods like the Bayview Hunters Points area, the Visitation Valley area, the Cow Palace area, I don't think anybody from that demographic has come to training.
Captain Tom says it's his job to do outreach to neighborhoods that have less NERT members, but it's been hard to get people to come to trainings. There are language barriers, socioeconomic gaps, and scheduling issues.
You know, some of these areas may have people working 2 or 3 jobs, so it's hard to hit that demographic.
The SF Fire Department has identified 105 neighborhoods in the city. Right now, only 36 of them have a NERT coordinator.
That's scary. Yeah.
And at the rate training is going, San Francisco won't reach their goal of having 40,000 NERT-certified residents for at least another 20 years.
We don't have enough funding to hit that capacity. We are very, very small budget of the city budget. But we're expected to, you know, take care of the whole city.
In the 2022-2023 SF City budget, NERT got around $340,000 out of the fire department's almost $500 million budget. That's less than 0.1%.
Every year that there's financial difficulties, NERT is always one of the first programs that looks to get cut.
Captain Tom wants to be realistic. He doesn't expect to train 30,000 SF residents overnight. Right now, his goal is just to get more NERT coordinators into neighborhoods. He said if 30 more neighborhoods had a NERT coordinator, the city would be in much better shape. But it's not clear how long that's going to take. In the meantime, NERT trainings happen monthly in San Francisco, and they're completely free. You can find out more about NERT and see their training schedule at sf-fire.org/NERT. In San Francisco, I'm Ren Farrell for Cross Currents.
Ren is KLW's emergency preparedness reporter. You can find the rest of his work at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Government efforts to clear out homeless encampments were paused during the COVID-19 pandemic, but they've been increasing across the Bay Area in recent months. In Berkeley, at a large encampment around the intersection of 7th and Harrison Streets, residents have pushed back. Jessica Prado is an award-winning photojournalist and lives in an RV there. Now she faces the prospect of being displaced again. She's currently involved in a lawsuit against the city of Berkeley to prevent the sweep. The lawsuit claims the city has failed to provide accommodation for all the residents being displaced. KLW's Sunni Khalid spoke with her about her experiences as a resident of the encampment.
Now, you have an unusual story. How long have you been living out of a RV?
Yeah, I've actually been living in my recreational vehicle for 6 years now. And I'm looking for a way out of this situation as well, looking for housing, but it's not as simple. You know, like once you're on the street, it's a hard way to kind of climb out. Yeah.
And you're working every day.
Yes, I'm working every day. And trust me, like, I think like one of the issues that happens, like for me, is that like, sometimes I'm not even sure if I'm safe to leave home to go to work. Like, that's something I have to think about constantly every day. Like, is it safe for me to step out and go to work?
And why is that?
Because I just don't know whether parking enforcement will show up and, you know, could do something to my vehicle. Or there's always this planned sweeps that really just throw my life into chaos again, because then you have to constantly think, it's like, where are you going to go next? So just that thought process of having to always, like, problem solve everything, you're just in constant stress, so it's difficult.
Well, your vehicle moves. It's actually working, but there are a lot of people whose vehicles are not working. What problems are unique to them, people who are living in RVs or other vehicles, and they can't move them or can't move them easily?
Yeah, I mean, even though my vehicle moves, yeah, it's not an easy thing to just, like, go ahead and move it. Because sometimes I have to jumpstart my vehicle to get it going. And that happens. Like, a lot of people have mechanical problems in their recreational vehicles and vehicle homes overall because, I mean, they were just not prepared to live in this kind of situation. They just grab any vehicle that they were able to find and afford, and they just started living in it. So a lot of these things, because they're cheap, you know, they're not working. A lot of mechanics also in the Bay Area don't even focus in, like, repairing RVs. Like, I've actually tried to find a mechanic to repair my RV, and it's been so difficult to even find one because they also have to store your vehicle there. And the vehicle is so big that they don't want to keep them in their mechanic shops. And also, where are you going to live in the meantime that it's being repaired? So people are really stuck in a situation.
What happens when parking enforcement comes and a vehicle can't be moved? What happens then?
I mean, what happens is that they just get towed away to the tow yard. And a lot of the issues that recently Berkeley has been doing is that they just don't just get towed to the impound. Now they also get destroyed. So people are not even able to get their vehicles back if they wanted to. Like, if they're not able to move at all, the tow yard won't even give them back anymore, which is unfortunate because now that person has lost their home and without having any kind of replacement to that.
What about fines?
Yeah, and the fines piled up. For example, so once your vehicle has been towed, like, you're having to pay for the tow, which is like about $400. Then you have to also pay for the storage, which is about like $100 or $120 every single day. And the towyer only keeps the vehicle up to 30 days. So by then, even if they kept it those 30 days, you owe about $3,000 in just storage fees alone. So that's why a lot of people also can't get the vehicles out, because it just piles up every single day that they have it there.
Tell me about some of the people who are in the camps. What sort of challenges are they facing?
Yeah, so it's not just the people that live in vehicles, but also the people that live in the tents and the structures. So about 80% of the encampment is actually, like, have, like, some real, like, disabilities. And a lot of them are, like, mental health disabilities, physical disabilities, and just, like, really chronic health problems, kind of like, you know, COPD, which is, like, cardiovascular. And basically, it can cause you to have a heart attack. So a lot of people have all these chronic illnesses, too, that just put them in jeopardy. And then when a stressful event, like a sweep, happens, it just puts people over the edge. And that's what has been basically happening right now.
How many people are still at the encampment, and what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks over the Christmas and New Year's holiday?
Yeah, I mean, right now we're really hoping that we don't lose the only safe place that we know that we can be.
What is your interaction with the city, and what is your interaction? Who are you dealing with? You're dealing with the Berkeley Police Department, Berkeley Fire Department, CHP. Who are you dealing with? Who actually comes to enforce the shutdown?
So we basically now we're dealing with different forces. Before, it only used to be the Berkeley Homeless Response Team, which is the team that's designated to respond to encampments. But now you have also the police, and you also have the fire department, who actually come out to basically enforce codes. So basically, the fire department is enforcing fire code violations, basically saying that the structures that people live in are not fire safe, which is totally understandable. And we know that. But it's like, if you don't help them be compliant to actually be fire safe, then how do you expect people to be fire safe? And I think the only option that they've taken is like by destroying the hazard, then they have, you know, mitigated that complain. But at the end of the day, that person's left without a home. You know, yes, you mitigated the fire hazard, but now you left that person without even the basic necessities to live.
Recently, there's been some news that Governor Gavin Newsom has proposed about $400 million to help local municipalities actually close down homeless encampments. What does that mean to you? What does it mean to folks in your community? Is this going to make much of a difference?
I would like to be hopeful and say that it could make a difference. But like, the thing is that because there hasn't been any accountability on how cities can actually use this money, people have not been helped. Like, yes, the encampment is resolved by like moving people out of there. But are those people actually connected to the resources that the grant promised? Because the grant basically says that you're supposed to be connecting all these people to housing, you know, and social services that they might need, whether that's mental health or substance use, they should be connected, right? But that hasn't happened because at the end of the day, the cities don't have to turn in a report to say, hey, I house all these people. Like, they don't even do that.
Jessica, you are young, you are talented, you are skilled, you are educated, and you're homeless. But you're not alone. How has the vehicular homeless situation changed in the last 3 years since you and I have been talking to each other? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? Has it stayed the same because we're coming out of COVID?
Well, basically, after the restrictions of COVID were lifted, that's basically when parking enforcement started functioning again. So we were not off the hook for a long time. Like, they were just ticketing us like right away, right after the summer started. And tickets were coming back. If anything, now there's more parking restrictions everywhere, even in San Francisco and in Berkeley. Like, they're making specific streets be like no parking zones or be a 4-hour parking zone. Like, this is a way to basically mitigate people from parking a longer time there, but not actually addressing their situation. But yeah, it's just parking restrictions are increasing everywhere, and we're just kind of running out of streets where we can actually legally park.
Where are you going to go?
Well, right now I'm parking in an area that became a 4-hour zone, and basically they've just been giving us tickets for that. I'm trying to find other areas where I can park in West Berkeley, but honestly, right now the whole city is going through a transition period. Like, there's a lot of construction going on. A lot of the places where the encampments used to be in the city have now been dismantled because there's construction happening there. So at the end of the day, it's like we're running out of spaces on where we can actually be. So right now, I plan to stay in the area where I am right now until we can actually find a safe place.
That was Jessica Prado, a photojournalist and resident of a homeless encampment in Berkeley, speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. Since that interview was conducted, a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order preventing the city from sweeping the encampment where Jessica lives. There will be a hearing on whether to stay the order later this afternoon. And we've reached out to the city of Berkeley for a comment on the lawsuit, but did not receive a response in time before our broadcast. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, it's an episode from our series, New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. And today, we're featuring three books that celebrate San Francisco history and historic institutions. San Francisco author Beth Weingarner kicks us off with a reading from her new book, San Francisco's Forgotten Cemeteries.
It's about the history of the city's graveyards and the many dead secretly still buried here. Here's a key passage. James Marshall changed California history forever when he found traces of gold at Sutter's Mill in Coloma, California, 130 miles east of San Francisco. The discovery brought floods of people to California and its city by the bay. City officials quickly realized they needed somewhere, somewhere larger than the city's existing graveyards, to bury the dead. In March 1850, William Eddy, the city's surveyor, staked out a 15-acre property at Market and Larkin Streets and claimed it was the perfect spot for an official cemetery. It was located along the existing road to the mission, and it was easy to get to. It was also on the very edge of town, surely far enough away to keep it from bothering any residents. Perhaps naively, Eddy told the Daily Alta California that there is, quote, enough town property in that locality to make a cemetery sufficient to accommodate the dead of the city for the next half century. Within 8 years, Yerba Buena Cemetery was full.
That was Beth Weingartner reading from San Francisco's Forgotten Cemeteries. It came out in August. Next, Oakland author Alex Scott reads from his latest book, Oldest San Francisco. It's about the institutions that made the city what it is.
So the oldest restaurant, funeral home, and hat maker. The first Blue Jeans, Rainbow Flag, and Mission Burrito. One of the entries concerns the oldest pottery, Heath, founded in San Francisco in 1948. This is the start of that entry. As a child, Edith Kirchner saw her large Danish-American family lose its farm in Iowa. In the auction of their belongings, no one bought their dainty Haviland china from France. When Edith decided to start making her own ceramics, she wanted to produce something that was as far from Sunday best porcelain as possible. "I don't like highly stylized things," she said. "I like easy, soft shapes on things. Things that are more like a folk dance than a ballet." And the pottery she would make had these easy, soft shapes, this stylish absence of evident style. "I didn't think the American way of life was that disciplined. People are more easygoing, less concerned with status." She knew she wanted to make stoneware in earthy colors, its main ornamentation a speckled glaze. But she could find no commercial clays to give her the dishes in her head. So she and her husband Brian Heath, then the head of the Red Cross in San Francisco, spent many weekends clambering down into abandoned quarries and creek beds until, outside of Sacramento, she found some clay that felt just so.
That was Oakland author Alex Scott reading from his book Oldest San Francisco that came out in October. And if you're interested in hearing from some of the places featured in Alex's book, check out our episode where we tour some of them. Find it online at klw.org/crosscurrents. And finally, we'll hear from Anne Kappas, the Director of Art Partnerships at Creativity Explored. It's a San Francisco institution, a nonprofit that supports people with developmental disabilities to make art. Their new book is Art is Art.
In recognition of 40 years of art making by disabled artists at Creativity Explored, I've gathered hundreds of visually inspiring original artworks then invite you to examine and challenge your own perceptions about disability. I'll share an excerpt from Celebrate with Cake. Several artists have become master pastry chefs using paintbrushes and oil pastel crayons instead of a whisk. Camille Holvet loves to draw desserts. Because of health issues that require limiting her sugar intake, Camille sublimates her desire for sweets by creating elaborate goodies on paper. Her popular, giant, colorful cakes, sometimes with crossed eyes, transform everyday treats into loaded ideograms, packed with her own memories, fears, and cravings. Yukari Sakura addresses some more somber issues in her confections. She painted a series of memorial dedication desserts that commemorate popular figures like Prince and David Bowie to victims of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. Despite the dark side to some of these delectables, there will always be cake.
and creativity explored artists will continue to celebrate by eating it, drawing it, and sharing their masterpieces with others.
That was Anne Kappes from Creativity Explored reading from Art is Art. It came out in November. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can find more readings by Bay Area authors at klw.org/newarrivals. Taking a break for the next 2 weeks, but in the meantime, you can catch up on all our stories and podcasts, like the newest season of Uncuffed, our new series, Culture Keepers, and the latest arts interviews from Sights and Sounds. We've got plenty to keep you connected through the holidays. Just go to klw.org/crosscurrents. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist. This is San Francisco's Autumn Carol. She'll be performing this Saturday at Bottom of the Hill. Today's Cross Currents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Hadil, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.